Hi, this is Will. Before this week's episode, a quick note from our friends at Django Not Space.
Hey all, it's your friends Dawn Wages, Sarah Boyce, Tim Schilling, Sarah Abderrahman, and Rachel Calhoun calling in from Mission Control to invite you to join Django Not Space, a Django contributor mentorship program designed to help Django engineers who are passionate about open code and community contribute back to the framework. Together in an 8-week program, we explore open issues, strategize on execution, learn about ways to get involved outside of code, share and celebrate our wins, make friends, and invest sustainably in what hopefully will be a long career contributing as an open source leader.
So when programming, we often agree that it's better to be explicit than implicit. Mentoring new open source contributors allows us to be explicit in saying, "You are welcome, you are valued, and you can do this." We lift people up and share out the opportunities we're privileged with, and ultimately, this strengthens our community and Django itself. Because at Django, we're a community of key givers, not gatekeepers. If you run into a problem where we don't know the solution, but we know who does, we'll connect you with them. When an opportunity arises in other circles, we'll put your name forward. We want to see you grow and lead the next group. Django is for everyone, and everyone can belong at Django.
Let's talk dates. The best place to learn about them is our website, djangonaut.space. But since I have your ears, I'll tell you that the 2024 Session 1 program will begin on January 15th. It will run for 8 weeks and end on March 11th. Applications will only be accepted until November 15th of this year, 2023. Now that date will be here before you know it, so start working on them now. We'll be sending invitations to the accepted folks starting on December 1st, and we promise to notify each individual about the status of their application. Best of luck, and we're looking forward to some very difficult choices.
Hey everyone who would like to contribute to Django or third-party projects can apply. We expect people to have experience with Python, Django, and Git. They should be able to commit 5 hours a week. Although everyone can apply, we prioritize folks who come from backgrounds that are excluded, overlooked, or have been excluded in the past. This is to help increase the diversity of Django contributors, as it's a framework for everyone, created by everyone. If you recognize yourself in this description, don't hesitate to apply. We are also recruiting navigators and captains if you would like to be part of the program and help future contributors to grow. A key skill you will need is the ability to listen for things going unsaid. For example, you may have to help them through some shyness or embarrassment. You should be empathic and comfortable asking open-ended questions to let them talk. Finally, you will need to support and celebrate Django Notes, providing connection as needed.
So, have we convinced you yet? You can learn more at djangonaut.space and click on Sessions to apply for the next cohort. Want to sponsor, volunteer, or apply, but have more questions? Email us at contact@djangonaut.space.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got with us Natalia Bidat, who's the new Django Fellow. Hi, Natalia. Thank you for coming on.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
No, we're very excited. We're very excited. So, look, we always start with a backstory. And you're as a new fellow, you're like, who is this person? Tell us all about you. How did you find your way into Django and where you are now? But, like, go on, start from the back. What's the origin?
Okay, how much time do I have?
Because we've got an hour, so go, we'll just sit back.
I started with computers at a very late age. I was in my 20s. There is, a sort of like a cultural and the social environment that I was in, it wasn't that common for female to be involved with computers at an early age. The males that were my same age, they used to play games, but in family games and Commodore computers, but it wasn't that common for female. And because of I will say, lack of encouragement and lack of self interest in that. I didn't get involved in computers. And what I did like during high school was everything that was related to math, accounting, and economy. And I was really, really convinced that I was going to be an accountant. In fact, I really liked the numbers. So at one point, I said, oh, I'm going to be an accountant. But then I realized that I also really liked, you know, organizing things and having procedures for things. So I decided, no, what I want to really study is system engineering. And I started talking with the partner of my aunt. And he was at the moment studying computer science in a school in Córdoba, Argentina, which is a faculty very is known for being very demanding of students. It's the faculty where you also study mathematics, physics, and astronomy. They were recently, as of 10 years ago at that time, started the computer science career in there. So he was studying that, and he was like, no, you want to study computer science, no system engineering. And I'm like, why? And he explained, and I was like, okay, but I need to study a lot. I mean, I need to put a lot of hours, and I'm not built for this. And he was like, no, yes, you should try it. So I started a career. I started computer science when I was 19. And the first years during the career, we barely touch a computer. We had all the theory about, you know, paradigm, logic, mathematics, discrete mathematics, and all that. And during my second year, we started having a little more of computers, and we have this subject which was organization of a computer. You know a little bit more about the different components and the electronic components and things that you can do with that. And it was really funny because one professor say he was talking about a computer bus, you know, and a bus this and a bus that. And I was like, what is a bus? And he was like, you know, when you opened your computer and you saw these little gold strips that you have in there. And I'm like, I've never opened a computer. I have no idea what you're talking about. So anyway, he's an amazing professor. He explained other things, and I graduated, and I came to love computer science. I was a student assistant while I was still studying. I was then a teacher assistant when I graduated, and I was for many years. And sort of in parallel, close to when I was close to graduate, I was living for 2 months in France, in Paris, doing an internship at the INRIA Institute. It's the Institute of Research, of Informatique Research, I believe it is. And when I came back, I did my final work, which is called a thesis in Cordoba, but it's a work after a 5-year degree that you study computer science. And before graduation, I got I got offered a job from a local startup in Cordoba, which was called Accept. Just like, you know, the try accept clause, it was accept. So they started working with Python, and at the time, this is 2005. They work with SOAP and a little bit of Plum, because Plum was just, you know, a new thing. So I already knew some Python, very newbie. I was very newbie. So I started working with them, and I started learning SOAP and a tiny bit of Plum. And then, you know, they were like startup, and they were sort of like a consulting. They were selling, you know, developer hours. They were working with people from the US. So the other project that I was involved with was building media management system for church, some part of the church of the United States, where there will be presentations that they will stream during the mass. I'm not sure if mass is the right term for, but I think it is. And this media management system was built in Eiffel. You know the programming language? Do you know what that is? Eiffel? I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Eiffel?
I've not seen
it. Like the tower, you know, Eiffel?
Yeah, but I've not seen that one. Anyway, carry on.
It's an amazing. It's a object-oriented programming language, imperative, and it's all the nice theory about programming languages. It's like put in that language, but it's not very common. It's not very popular, as you can see. I also worked on that programming language, and then Django was out. It was like 0.9 release, and these startups started using Django for all the projects. So I started using it as well with them, and well, from then it was, you know, a learning process, and we started using Django a lot. And then the startup had to close because, you know, it wasn't working economically, financially. And at that time, in 2009, I joined Canonical. And at Canonical, I joined the Ubuntu-1 team. Ubuntu-1, right now, it's just the SSO, the single sign-on service from Canonical. But at the time, Ubuntu-1 was the service that would provide initially file sync capabilities, and then it will also provide music streaming, contact sync, and some other features. So I joined the team that was called the Foundations team. We will build the file sync server, which was Python and Twisted, the WEM framework that will run on the server and on Canonical's cloud. And then we'll have the daemon that will run on all the desktop that will be pure Python. Well, sorry, Python and Twisted as well. And that will run on all the systems. So we'll be in charge of the daemon and the server. It was, I learned a lot. The people working in the team were senior or super senior. So I was a sort of like a junior developer still. I learned a lot, and I basically grew from junior to semi-senior to senior working with them. It was a very fun experience, and I enjoyed it a lot. I was then moved to the Ubuntu-1 desktop team, where we built a desktop UI for the daemon, initially in GTK, which was called the control panel, and then we used PyQt to build that. So I also did a little bit of that, PyGTK and PyQt. That was also fun and very interesting. I learned a lot as well. And then I enjoy a little bit more doing server side, not that much desktop stuff. So I was moved back to what was called at the time the online services team. So it was a team that will deal with everything online regarding backend services. And it was all Python and perhaps some Twisted, some Django. And we were in charge of the Ubuntu single sign-on service, which was Ubuntu payments at the time, which it was killed afterwards, and still be in charge of the Ubuntu One server services. At some point in 2014, Ubuntu One as a product was shut down. The single sign-on remained and still is being used by Canonical. And I was moved to the team behind the package store. Canonical has had many package stores during the years. Initially, one that will allow you to upload Debian packages, but not via the usual archives, via this custom store provided by Canonical, where it will be easier to get your Deb package available to users, and not needing, you know, to go through all the Debian process. And so I was involved in that. And then that package store started morphing. And I believe that's the right pronunciation. That's the right word. I'm not sure if I'm pronunciating properly. It morphed into support. I mean, Canonical started developing new package formats to you know, share software. So after the devs, it was the Click packages, and then soon after it was the Snap packages, which had an initial version which was very similar to Clicks, and then a second version which was completely different to Clicks, but what's still called Snap, which is what currently Canonical offers as a package format. So
and they really like you to use.
You they really like you.
No, they really like you to use it. They're like, please do.
Yeah, I will try to stay away from making judgments about that. I will try to keep to be, you know, objective about as I can about the topic. So Yeah, I was involved in all this morphing. The original Django service was providing the dev package store, morph into supporting clicks and then into supporting snaps. And it was a mess, a monster of if everywhere, still Django. So at some point, it was decided that we were going to try to deprecate this Django monster and spin off of many microservices which weren't that micro, sort of like a medium services built in Python and Flask. So I believe I left Canonical 1 year and a half ago, and I think that they're still using a little bit of everything, a little bit of the monster, a little bit of the monster's child or derivatives. And but yeah, I decided, during my time in the package store, I became a technical leader and a technical architect of the store. And well, I left a year and a half ago, and overall was a great experience. I learned a lot of things, a lot of regarding technical stuff, developing features from scratch, and then a lot regarding communicating with people, being in charge of the technical aspect of things and in charge of, you know, teams and how to push a feature forward. And I dealt with customers, with commercial customers that will use the Snap Store for IoT things. And I think that's a fair summary.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Just
the best summary we've had in doing all our episodes. We're just like, just wind you up and go. Like,
what I also like though, as well, in that massive long summary, that you've touched literally every major Python web framework. You've got Plone, you've got Soap, you've got Twisted, you've got Django, you've got Vars.
I never used Tornado, for example. I have idea. Or Pyramid, I believe it's another one. I have no idea either. But yeah. I love Twisted.
That's super.
Now would be Fast API would be the one now, right?
Well, yeah, I haven't tried in pet projects. I haven't used it in anything, you know, serious in terms of stressing it. But yeah, I really like it as well.
So can I ask then, what attracted you to being a Django fellow then, or being the fellow when that role came up?
That's a good question. So as I mentioned, I naturally tend to try to organize things, organize people, organize work, organize features. At the same time, when I left Canonical, I was extremely, extremely burnt out. I was like, I don't want to work ever again. Work is not for me. I was in a privileged position in that I could say that, and I could decide to do that. My partner is still working, and you know, I was able to say, okay, I don't want to work for a year, for 2 years, or for 5 years. So that was one thing that helped me be in a position that I could choose. No, I could wait, and I could also decide from the point of view of what I really wanted to do. I always loved Django, and I wanted to keep involved with Django. At the time, it didn't occur to me to start, you know, contributing to Django. That is something that, or retrospective, I would have loved to do. And I will explain why in a minute. But I started working like 6 months after I quit with RevSys, Revolution System, the consultancy for Django services, and I realized how much I loved working with Django. And then in February, almost a year after I resigned, I saw the opening for Django Fellow, and I read the description, and I was like, you need to try it back. You need to, you know, keep the order of things. You know, you have to keep the bugs in shape and the PRs in shape, and you have to deal with security issues. I also did that while in Canonical. I was part of a response team when we got reports of malicious apps and stuff. So, I can do this. And this is Django. And I will be contributing to Django. And I will be get paid to contribute to Django. I was like,
win,
really?
Win, win, no?
Yes. I mean, I couldn't see a reason why I wouldn't, you know, send my application to that. And I was super excited. And I started gathering recommendation letters from people And I put together my application and I sent it, and I got the position, and I was extremely happy. I felt and I feel so lucky, so fortunate to have this opportunity. And then when I started actually, you know, the fellowship, I didn't feel so useful, but that's not the question that you ask, so I wouldn't get into that yet. This is why
Okay, but that's you. I'm not going to let that one just hang. So it's like it's quite a difficult role, right? There's a lot to it, and it's not. So how do you find starting? How is it like, you know, coming fresh to it and being like, oh wow? Because I remember when I started, I was working on REST framework, but I wasn't working on Django, and I was working on some other packages, but I wasn't working on Django. And Django is a much different beast from, you know, maintaining a third party package. And so I had Tim giving me help. I had Marish giving me nice little comments and, you know, from on the side, I had a lot of people helping me, but I needed that help too. And it was important to me. So, you know, it took a while to find my feet. How, you know,
well, for me, I'm when people I know, people I care about, ask me about how are you feeling, I am, and I'm saying I feel useless. I feel like I'm wasting the DSF money. Why? They say, I mean, you're like ideal for this role, and I am like, I use this analogy. I usually use analogies to explain things, and I have this one for this particular situation. I feel like using Django is, for example, like driving a car or driving, you know? You might know how to drive a stick. You might know how to drive an automatic car. You might know how to drive different models, a bigger car, a smaller car, a truck, or perhaps a motorcycle. You know how to drive. And you might have, you know, the longer that you have been driving, you might have more experience, you know, how to drive in a freeway, or how to drive, you know, in a small road, or a road without any pavement. Is that the right word?
Pavement, yeah.
So if you're an experienced driver, you know how to do these things. But all of a sudden, I feel like I need to fix a car engine. I'm like, I don't know how to do that. I mean, it's like I get a report, the yellow cable it should be tied to the red cable, and it's not. And I'm like, what does the yellow cable do? What does the red cable do? I don't know. I know how to drive this thing very nicely, but I don't know how to fix it. So all of a sudden, I am, you know, opening the car. It's not the trunk. Hood. Yes. Thank you. And I'm looking at the engine, and I'm like, okay, I know that this is, you know, the refrigerant liquid, and I know that this is the radiator. And I know this is the engine, but I don't know anything else. It's like, I can see if a cable is not connected, but I don't know how to reattach it. So that's how useless I feel at the beginning. I feel like someone with a previous record of contributing to Django might have been more efficient from the beginning, more useful from the beginning, and in doing these things, I felt like at the beginning, I felt like I was doing everything wrong, you know, commit messages, format of things, format of doctrine, format of I don't know, diffs, replies, drop choices that I chose on drop downs. Everything. And while I understand it's a learning process, where I have, you know, conversations with you, Carlton, and for the other people, and you were all super encouraging. And I have learned a lot, and Mariusz was super helpful, and other people were super helpful. And the community is great. They will never told me, you're wasting the DSS money. I'm only telling that myself, you know? But yeah, that's basically the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I said I had exactly that, because I wasn't a patch in Django or two patches in Django, but that was it. I wasn't a contributor. I wasn't maintaining Django when I started as a fellow. I got the role because of my work in the other packages. And then, you know, first day, ORM ticket. Ah, okay, let's dig into the ORM. Let's find out. I don't know. And the code, you know, we got black these days, but it was wrap, you know, wrap this. full stop here. You know, the formatting. I did a PR this week and Maris says, please wrap the comment to 79 cars. This is years later. Like, yeah, it's just like that. It's just like that.
I know. But still, I was coming from a leadership position, a technical leadership position. I was coming from a position where I was very comfortable and I was very sure of the decisions that I was making, of the things that I was making. When someone come to me saying, how should I do this? I always had the answer and I was very confident, you know? So all of a sudden, I find myself in a very uncomfortable position where I feel like I don't know anything. So that's also a personal challenge, you know, there are some things that I need to work on and that I need to adapt to. And again, all the people surrounding me has been nothing but supportive. So it's more of a personal learning, actually, and I embrace it. It's great.
Yeah, super. And just from the outside, it, you know, from why I'm watch what you do, and I'm just like, yeah, knocking out the park every week. So super.
Let's talk about like a security bug fix release. What was, you know, because that would be one of the early things you would do. What was that like? Like,
actually,
how do you do it, right?
My first security release is going to be tomorrow. Oh. So,
so yes. That'll be, yes, I saw your announcements. So that this will come out a little bit after, but yeah, that'll be October 4th when it comes out.
Yeah. So, well, right. Sorry. It will be October 4th, which is tomorrow for me. The second release that happened since I started being a fellow was a security release, and that was already the assignment, because we have 1 month each fellow. So 1 month me and 1 month Marius. So in May, it was Marius' turn, and there was a security release. So he said, okay, we should screen share, and I will walk you through the process. So he did all the things. I took all the notes that I could. But imagine that at the time, I didn't even make a regular release myself. So I took a lot of notes of things that I had no idea what were they and what was part of a security release and what wasn't part of a security release. And is everything super relevant? Where can I mess up, you know, this process? And I didn't have that view yet. Anyway, I took a lot of notes. And then it was sort of like a faith thing, that I didn't have a security release during my term. It was like all the month I was like, finger crossed, this is not a security issue. We were having a security, you know, reports. So we will investigate, we will agree, as the whole security team will agree on a path forward. And when the decision was, this is not a security issue, I was like, yay, because next month, it's my turn. But last month during September, we had this report, and actually I say, I mean, so for different reasons that I cannot discuss yet, this needs to be a security issue. So I decided, okay, this is going to be the month that I'm going to the security release, and we'll see how that goes. But I'm not sure if you want to propose another question or if I can just build on top of what you.
Yeah, build.
Okay. So I think that you said, how is it like, you know, all the releases, the minor releases, the main releases. And this is a little bit of a follow-up of what I said about how I feel being a fellow. I still feel, so since during the first 2 months as a fellow, I felt extremely frustrated for the things that I already shared. And I was working actively towards reverting that. You know, I talked to people, I tried to focus on things that I felt I was adding value to, you know, and that helped a lot. But since then, and still, I sort of have this feeling like I'm always a little bit behind of things. You know, sometimes Mariusz makes a comment like, yeah, right now we're in this part of the process. And I'm like, oh, are we? Really? Okay. I try, you know, I'm like running the train from behind, and I always barely catch it. I think I'm still catching it, but and for the alpha release, I will be super honest, and this is, I think, the why of what I'm going to say is a mix of different factors and things. I wasn't quite, I didn't quite understand what was to be a release manager at the time. And I wasn't quite, I didn't have a clarity on what I had to be doing prior to the alpha release. And in retrospective, it's hard for me to forgive me. Myself, you know, forgive myself for not having that clarity. In that, I mean, I know it went well. I know that it's a learning process. But now, you know, with information that I have right now, I felt like I should have been taking care of new features a little bit more actively than I did prior to the alpha release. I didn't have that clarity. Now I know. I mean, when Marius mentioned this aloud, I was like, of course, that is obvious. What I didn't think of is this sooner. So, you know, I started putting all my energy towards that. But yeah, I mean, my overall feeling, the answer is I'm always a little bit behind of things, and I'm just catching up all the time. And I try to do my best.
I was following for 5 years, and I always felt like that. Like, it's just how it is. And an alpha release is just the hardest thing in the world. Like, there's so many moving parts, so much to do, so many bits that aren't automated and difficult to work out exactly what you have to do from the checklist and where are the things. And you just have to do it several times. It's a learning process. And I just think you did wonderfully. Like, you just, you know, everything about it just went really smoothly. And, you know, you could, because you're in Argentina, like, your time zone's well behind, but, like, you know, you put the release out and I didn't know whether it was going to go out that day or the next day. But, you know, when I woke up in the morning, it was like, you got it out in your afternoon, and it's like, oh, just super and glitchless. So I keep saying the same thing. You're doing a great job. And it's just lovely to hear your experience, because it just mirrors mine exactly. It's like, it's just, you got that feeling. I never, ever, ever got away from that feeling. Like, an alpha release, just, you know.
Okay, so now I'm a little bit worried. Am I going to feel like behind all the time?
No, but you're a much more solid professional than I am. You'll have it all down in no time at all.
Well, thank you. I think we're both very solid professionals, and maybe in different ways, but okay.
Well, welcome to the
love. So I've heard Carlton mention, but for you, are there any particular features or new things in 5.0 that you're excited about or that were challenging? Like, you know, being on the inside, what was, you know, what's your perspective?
I have like a mixed feelings toward that, to the answer to that question, because I have like two things. One thing is the one that I was the most involved with. So I started to grow, you know, some I was very fond to the thing that I invested on. This is something that Nick and Tom started, which is, you know, supporting dictionaries for choices in model field choices, because we already had, I'm mixing some things. So supporting dictionaries or any mapping for defining choices, that is something that is new. And there was a lot of work put in that, and I pushed it to the final line. And that feeling of, you know, completing something and having that merge was amazing. So I have this, you know, special place in my heart for that feature.
Yeah, and go on. I just want to say that was a great finish off, because that PR was sat there for a year and a half or 2 years while it was sort of just bumbling away of, oh, this is really hard to finish. And you picked it up and took it well over the line. So.
Yeah, well, and then with Nick's work, he took the normalization of choices to the next level in his PR. So with that work, groundwork in place, it was super easy to provide support for callables for model field choices. So you can now define your callable for that. And that is something that I, as a user, as a driver, of course, I have wanted for a long time, because I have concrete use cases for that. So that's one thing that I really appreciate about the release. And then the other thing is, yes.
God, I just wanted to ask on that. How did that work out with migrations? Because one of my sort of bugbears, I know we had a half conversation, but I didn't follow off quite how it finished. But one of my bugbears is you change the choices and then you get a migration. It's like, do I really want a migration for this? I don't know. How did that wrap up?
So Are you familiar? I just got familiar with it. Are you familiar with how the callable default is defined in migrations for a model field? You know, you can have a callable for the default. So basically,
it's the callable path. It's the whole import path for the.
Yes. So basically, yeah. So I mirror that. When you define a callable for a default, what you will get in the migration is the actual import path of the function or method that you're defining for that default argument. So the migration serializer already had all the machinery in place for saying, okay, so this is a function. I will do all the magic necessary in order to serialize this into something that works. The only thing that I needed is, on one hand, to say on the model end that when you have choices, in the deconstruct method of a field, it was really important, you know, to be sure that the choices was returned in the deconstruction result as the function itself, because for supporting dictionaries and the normalization of choices, Nick started using a wrapper around functions for very specific reasons. So we needed to unwrap that and to provide the function in the deconstruct module. And then the other point, which was a little bit... a parallel thing, but it was a nice thing to have. One of the use cases for having callables for choices will be to have, you know, computations that might be potentially expensive, either CPU bound or EO bound, to be cached. So you might use the cache decorators from the Python standard library. So if you use those, the serializer for migrations will fail, because it will not see the function as a function. It will see the specific type that is returned by the cache decorators of Python. So we had the support for that. Well, actually, Nick had the support for that. And that just worked. Does that answer your question?
It does, because I think I can change the implementation of my function without generating a migration.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
That's what I want.
Super. Yes, and that's then, what I want as well.
Brilliant. Sorry, that's a deep dive there. So what was the second thing?
The second one, yes. The other one that I really, really like, I wasn't involved nor in discussion of the feature, nor in discussion of the design, nor in any of the reviews. So I might get a small detail wrong, but you know, having the compound fields where you're able to, I love that. I mean, I have many projects that define the user full name as a property where you combine the first name and the last name, and you know how all this logic, whether one of the two is empty and you will not have a space in between or the order or whatever, and being able to define that as a field, I mean, I think that's amazing. That's just what
I was thinking about it today. That ties in with the lookups. So I was looking at enumeration, and I've got a property which picks, is it one of one, two, or three from the enumeration? And to have a generated field that had that, or, you know, the other option is to have a lookup which encapsulates that logic. It just makes your code a lot cleaner, you know.
Absolutely. And well, in the past, I have tried to work around this, the lack of this feature, which is now available, by having either annotations on the overriding the default query set and having annotations in there, but that will not provide the same attribute name at the instance level. So if you just do a get, you will not get the same attribute, calculated attribute on the instance. So you will need a property, but the property cannot be named with the same string that you use for the annotation. So I love that feature. Yeah. And of course, I mean, the DB defaults, I think that's great. I haven't had that specific need myself. Well, actually, I think I have. I haven't given enough thoughts on how the feature could solve very challenges that we have had at the professional level, you know, when adding columns to big tables. So I'm pretty sure that there's a benefit there, but I haven't, you know, put any time to thinking about that. But I'm sure that, I know that's an amazing and great feature. And it was an enormous effort from the people involved into getting that in. So I think that's also amazing.
Yeah, I mean, both of those tickets were open more than a decade, right?
Yeah.
You know, so not non-negligible. Can just step back there. Can I ask, sort of, have you got a take? Have you got a thoughts on, like, despite the fact that Django is really old, that these massive new features are coming in?
Sorry, what's the question? I missed.
Well, the question is, do you have a take on, like, you know, despite the age of Django, that these massive new features are coming in?
I suspect it's around how do we communicate this to other people? Like, right on the inside, you see it and you work with it, but people on the outside don't know how active and vibrant Django is, as opposed to other frameworks that are 20 years old and pretty much dead.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. And my answer might be a little bit wider than the question, but there are some things that I think that are relevant for that. For example, I have this colleague from Cordoba that we were just visiting Cordoba during September, during spring break, because it's spring in this part of the world. And, you know, I got together with some people from the university years and friends. And I said, like, oh, I'm super happy. I just released Alpha 1 for Django 5.0. Oh, okay, so they ask questions that I didn't quite understand, but then I realized they were asking, what's the feature that drove the release of 5.0? Like, instead of knowing that there is a release cadence that and the releases are going to happen with whatever features that made it in, they thought that the decision of where releasing a big new major version is based on, okay, we have this set of things that we want to accomplish, and only when we get this ready, for example, say, so we want to provide async across the whole stack, so we're going to work towards async, and that will be Django 6. So some people think that when there is a major release, it's because there is a specific feature that was planned, developed, and completed in order to, I will say, justify, but I think that's a fair term, justify that release. And I mentioned, no, this is something that is planned, and everything that gets in, it's there. So I mentioned, you know, many of the things. But I think that there was that confusion, and I sensed, but this also might be unfair, a feeling of disappointment in that response, in that, you know, like, oh, but then why would I go to Django 5? If there is nothing like concrete or specific that I can say, I'm running now Django 5 and it has this thing. And I was like, but you have all these other things. Yeah, but if I don't need them, it's like, well, but so it was like an awkward conversation in those terms. I mean, very friendly, of course, but I felt like perhaps communication in that front is something that could pay off, you know? I'm not sure how, and I've been thinking about this thing about communication from the Django community, the Django project as a whole. And I'm stuck a little bit in things that are not working. I could list things that are not working, but I don't have counter-proposal to make that criticism constructive. I only have criticism right now, and I don't think that's fair. More so in my position.
This is something we always ask guests. You know, if you could, be in charge and wave a wand, what would you change? I mean, for me, especially as a content creator dealing, you know, I'm beholden to the release schedule of the, you know, 0.0, 0.1, 0.2, and then the next thing. I would love to revisit that decision, because I often hear people don't assume that there's some major thing, and it's just, nope, it's whatever made it in on time, and we have an LTS policy. But people assume rightly that 5.0 is like this huge, huge thing versus 4.2, and it's often not the case. So, you know, for example, like what Python does, Python's on 3.12 just came out today. That'd be a lot clearer, and it'd make people feel like they're not so far behind, and it would clear up a lot of this confusion. But I think, so anyways, if I could wave a wand, in my top five is changing the version numbers for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think if this would be, I don't know, 4.6, it will be way clearer when compared to 5.0.
Okay, good. Violent agreement all around. So
yes. And then regarding your question about the magic wand.
Oh, yeah, please. Yeah.
I'm digging myself, you know, a hole here.
No, come on.
But this is, you know, this is what
we're not going to cut this.
You know, this is one of the things about the Django community is that, you know, there's online chatter and then there's Django cons if people can go, but it's not often that people can just have a conversation about it. And, you know, I think others might feel the same way.
Before you say your magic wand, I think the communication point you've made, I think, you know, we can just acknowledge that. I think historically we've not done the best job in communicating, and that's okay. We've done other things really well, and you can't necessarily do everything
right
perfectly every time. But
so this thing that bugs me is that I'm almost 13 years at Canonical and with Django, and while we kept an eye on releases and security releases because, you know, we were running servers running Django, so we needed to be very mindful of that. I mean, again, this is like a shared responsibility, but we didn't have any visibility of news on Django, and we maybe didn't follow Django on the right channels. I mean, perhaps Twitter or the thing or a news feed. But it's like I never got this, I don't know, trigger that will prompt me to think, am I following Django in the right channels? So with other things that it's not that I don't care about, with other things that are less important to me, it's like I get these, you know, reminders that are there, and I get to decide whether I want to know more about these things or not. With Django, it's like now that I am super involved, I see a lot of things happening. But I had this feeling, and it's an absolutely subjective measure that I'm going to provide. I don't know, only 10% of the people using Django get access to this stream of information. And I will say 5%. I don't know. I feel like from the whole users of Django, a very small subset is getting to know all the things that are going on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
With issues, with features, with releases, with the help needed, with, I don't know, how to contribute, how easy it is or how not easy it is, how they can, you know, come and help. I mean, it's fair that anything that you do actively requires, you know, time investment, and not everyone has it. And I can speak for myself regarding that. But then there is also, you know, lack of information. And I really am not sure what to suggest to do differently, because I don't know, is it like buying Twitter spots to I don't know, to advertise Django? No, is it, I don't know, having, you know, YouTube pay time to advertise Django? No, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't think those are, I'm just I would like to see more prominent Django things happening in the tech flow, of information. And I don't see that.
Jaime's the DSF president, has talked about this. One of the sort of four things that the DSF is meant to do is to promote the usage of Django. And perhaps that's the one that's been left historically, you know, no blame to anybody, but there's just what's been left. This is Haim's point he made in Porto at his DjangoCon Europe to talk there, was that, you know, it's one thing that the DSF could do, maybe not, you know, the current board, the current structure, it would need some thought as to how that would happen, but be to actually promote Django more, you know, try and shout from the rooftops that actually it's really cool and there's lots of progress and, you know, there's new features and I don't know. Will.
Yeah. Well, there was a panel at DjangoCon Europe on this this year that Haim was at. And the problem is that it's work. The problem is that people, you know, and we've made this point before, but the DSF is kind of the only body place that people think can decide things, but it already has its hands full and it's just seven members, ostensibly 1 hour a month. So, you know, working groups, I mean, the point I made in that panel, and it's part of why I stepped away from the board after 3 years, because I don't want to, I want people with new energy to come in, is that we need, you know, I think we need an executive director or someone in a paid position to do all these things and maybe decide, because people have lots of ideas, but we're all busy and it's hard. You know, a lot of these things are real work. So part of the Django News newsletter, which I do with Jeff Triplett from RevSys, is to fill that need. And because being on the board, I could see that there wasn't anyone really to do a newsletter. And then even if we did, like, so say I started an official Django newsletter, well, I wasn't going to be on the board indefinitely. Then that becomes part of the basket of Django things that have to be done, right? Just like new code features as a fellow, like you're putting the onus on future people. So much the way we have third-party packages, that's sort of, to me, how I think of the Django News newsletter, how I think of this Django chat podcast. But it's, I can attest, both of those are real work. And I think, you know, Django, like, for example, do you think Django could benefit from a third fellow? Would that, you know, would that speed up development, you know, like it?
Absolutely, yes. Django will benefit from a third fellow. But more so, and this is something that I keep thinking, and it was it's a recurring thinking, and it was something that bugged me at the beginning. I wasn't sure, I mean, how to prioritize things. There is so much to do. How do you prioritize things? When I was working in a commercial environment, it was easy. I had a manager and we had very clear, you know, goals. So it was very easy for me to prioritize things and get to the different things in an order that I felt added value to the ultimate goal. And I could lead people in order to, you know, follow those priorities and add value. I could, I don't know, make suggestion or change a few things, but there's always like this ultimate goal. Being a fellow, I sometimes, you know, think, okay, I should change the release documentation. So, you know, all these things that you said, Carlton, about what are the alpha release tag, which are security tags, I will do a complete refactor of that, and having, you know, even checkboxes or a template that you can copy and paste and have somewhere else, and you can, you know, click all the things that you did, automate things. We can automate like a lot more of what's already automated. And then I, okay, but there are a lot of tickets, three tickets to triage, a lot of open PRs. Giving feedback to community members contributing, I think, is super important, because if you have someone putting in time to provide, to try to contribute, and you are not acknowledging that and providing feedback, that is not only wasted time, but time that the other person put that is not being valued in the sense of having value from that, but also, you know, perhaps that contributor gets discouraged about continuing contributing because, you know, they feel like they are not getting, you know, enough attention. So there are many things that can be done. I don't know, and perhaps, you know, thinking about a proposal and how to communicate better, writing more blog posts. I could, you know, write things and try to publish in the different channels, or, I don't know, seek more opinions about how to communicate. Where would you like to see news about Django? But then, as a fellow, and I'm also part-time as you work, Carlton, what do I do first? Where is the most value in? I mean, how do I decide? And I don't have a manager. I mean, there are good reasons for that. I have a manager or someone, you know, to brainstorm. Well, I discuss with marriage, of course, but it's unclear where the money is best spent. I don't have that answer, and I would love to have it. With a third fellow, maybe there could be, maybe, this is just me, like, I don't know, rotation about writing content, where content is not, you know, content like the marketing world, but more like going through the documentation, fixing example, automating things, fixing docs specifically for developing Django, for releasing Django. And the other two might, you know, devote to triage and tickets and reviewing PRs and, you know, making that a run-robin thing, or maybe someone enjoys doing something more than others or feel that they have more value, maybe go in that direction. I don't know. I think that's something to evaluate if possible at all.
But I think one thing to take out of everything you've said is that there's just more work than the fellows can do. And so, you know, one thing that it you've quite said, oh, well, the fellows could do it. No, they couldn't. They literally can't take on more work than they've already got, any more than the board can. So if we want these things to change, it needs to be people from the community coming forward and helping to offer that work. And even if that needs a bit of input from the board or input from the fellows, it can't be like, oh, you know, we've got this structure and that takes care of an infinite amount of work. No, it barely copes with the work that it's already got. And it does a very good job and it keeps going and Django is super stable and has all these wonderful monthly releases and all the rest of it. But there is a limit to what's doable with the resources we have in hand now.
Yeah. Well, and that's why having fellows with different backgrounds is so important, because you bring different decisions. You know, really the fellows, I think, have a much bigger role than most people realize, right? I mean, it's you and Marius are contracted for time and it's like, here is this pile of work and, you know, go for it, right? Like you can get individual feedback, but there is no manager. It's really on you to decide those things. And it's a bigger role than it seems from the outside for most people.
Yeah, I would love to have someone say, and I mean, guiding towards priorities, but I understand the structure. So far I have been focusing on enabling the community to do things. I've been trying to do this, you know, seeing that the machinery works, trying, you know, to put oil on the gears that are not working properly. And I've been trying to focus on that because I feel that adds value, even if I don't know the internals of the ORM and I cannot do clever things with the ORM. I think that. But yeah, I think fellow will surely help. I'm not sure if that's feasible, though.
if you needed... if we really wanted input, you could reach out to the steering council, the fellowship committee, or, you know, other people, and, you know, there are people who would opine, I think, on that.
It's herding cats a little bit, though.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, in a way, I feel I'm not imposing in the bad way, but a little bit, you know, that... trying to find answers that perhaps are not there, and having people think of things that...
Ask for forgiveness, not permission, right?
Yes. So I've been going with that motto. I've been trying, you know, to do... From my point of view, what is the most value? Whether I do this or that? And I've been trying to follow that guy.
For me, one of the great rewarding things of doing the fellow role was that it was very autonomous and very, you know, you got to choose and you got to make those judgments and you were trusted to do so. And, you know, obviously you have to repay that trust by, you know, good faith. But that, you know, over time that was like, yeah, okay. I found that really rewarding. I don't know.
I think, I know several members of the steering council, for example, of course, most of the people there are in lots of other roles within Django, but that specific body doesn't do much. You know, maybe I can talk offline with you. You know, I think they're sort of like, well, we had these elections and here we are. And, you know, it's kind of like, unless there's this like really antagonistic thing, that body, for example, isn't doing a ton. But it all comes down to a community thing. That's one of the challenges. How do you make things happen? But it's also just that Django has a third-party package system. I think in marketing, you know, the newsletter with the podcast, like we can adopt that mindset. No one's going to stop you from doing the work. And then over time, either it's put into Django or it's not, but it can still be useful. I mean, it's one of the things I'm thinking about Django that's astounding is that our conferences are volunteer run. Like no one does that that I'm aware of, like, especially tech conferences, which often are a lot of work and a lot of money you have to deal with. And that's something the DSF deals with, trying to help DjangoCon US, Europe, now Africa. But it's almost an astounding thing. Like, wait, you have a conference of hundreds of people in a different location, and it's just like people in the community do it, like, out of the goodness of their heart? Because that's, you know, speaking of real work, that's crazy real work to do one, let alone. But it's communication. There's so many things like that within Django, translation teams, all this stuff that just people aren't aware of. How do we communicate that? I don't know.
Am I going to see you in DjangoCon US?
Yes. Are you going to be there?
Yes.
Yes. I think Carlton's staying home.
No, I can't make it this year. I've had something of a year, and I'm going to take the autumn off. But you know, hopefully next time you come, can we get you to DjangoCon Europe next spring?
I will. I mean, I'm currently planning around that in that positively. Is that okay? I mean,
yeah.
I'm planning.
Yeah, yeah.
Towards that.
Well, if you make it there, I'll definitely be there. So if not, the next one, we'll get there.
I want to go with the family. We love Spain. And if we can, we're going to go with the family. So yeah. If not, I will try to be there.
I was just going to say, one thing at the DjangoCon is, and I know we're pretty close to time, is that there are these sprints at the end. And one of the proposals that has been coming around is there a way to have sprints outside of the DjangoCons? You know, either...
Yes.
Online or dedicated weekends, and that seems like things momentum is building around that as something that would really help the community, and just say that as a positive thing. We've listed some maybe negative things, but that's a very positive thing, and I expect there'll be more conversations at DjangoCon US around actualizing that idea.
That's good. In fact, I have participated of Django Sprints many years ago, more than 10 years ago. In all the occasions, it was a Django Sprint in the context of another event. For example, in Argentina, there are these Pi camps, which are really camps around Python. And we got together in very nice places, which are not with tents, but with housing. And we do coding for 3 years. And many times there have been, like a group of people interested in Django. We have done Django sprints. And then the first PyCon US that I went to, which is in Atlanta in 2010, I went to the Django sprint that was organized within the Python sprint. So I think that's also something to consider, organizing Django sprints in the context of a bigger thing, because it may help.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's a thing that happens in other frameworks and languages. So it's not us reinventing the wheel. It's reinvent whatever, you know what I mean? It's doing
yes.
Something that has already been
done. Reinventing the wheel. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're up to time now. So Natalia, is there any, while we've got you and you've got the mic, is there anything else we didn't call out? Anything you want to say or
Well, we had in our agenda to discuss inclusion, which
yes. Is
a topic that I'm very passionate about. Actually, I'm giving a talk in DjangoCon US about that topic, and I would love to discuss that in this space, perhaps in the future. But that would be great. I think it's important to discuss and reflect and keep bringing it up.
Okay. Well, have we got time to do it now, Will, or not?
Well, I
think she's tired. Yeah.
Okay. After, you're fine. After,
maybe,
done.
Maybe,
okay.
Maybe after it comes out, we can have you back on and have a link to it. And...
Right. I mean, I think that would be great because after the talk, if all goes well, I hope, we will have, perhaps more concrete material that we can grow and discuss, because I'm preparing the talk, and I have already, leaving a lot of things out of the talk or compressed topics that we can, dig deeper. So yeah, maybe after a few
months. Well, super.
Months.
Let's have you back on after DjangoCon, and we can talk
I
about
that.
That would be amazing.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the invitation. I have really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, really good talking to you. Really good.
And so looking forward to see you in DjangoCon.
I know, yeah, that'll be exciting. That'll be so exciting.
Okay. And I will see you next year in Europe, Carlton, some way or another.
Yeah, one way or the other.
Yeah, one way or another, yeah.
Well, we are at djangochat.com. That's where to find us. New episodes coming every 2 weeks. And we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.